The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to share the latest on what happens when we tune out with our brains. Also, how we can live a longer life. A special comment that I'm going to ask you to call in and share your thoughts on. A follow-up to yesterday's discussion about us becoming a police state. I'm going to share some insights from William Black, Dr. William Black, who was with the Reagan administration. He's a professor of economics, and we're going to talk about the banking scandal, rotten to the core. It's short, but it gives you an idea of why this latest scandal happened. Then I'm going to talk about free speech and why we should better understand our free speech rights. My guest in the second part of our program will be multi-award-winning investigative journalist Evelyn Pringle. And we're going to talk about the spider web of teen screen industry, big pharma, university researchers, and creating new psychological diseases that do not exist for young people and children so they can be drugged. All of which are not only being accepted, but even volunteering their children for anything that would get them some care. Let's say, get them on a drug. Well, how does that happen? How do you condition a whole nation that what you're doing is right without being challenged, except for a tiny minority of individuals? We'll talk about that in that discussion. Latest on the environment, Monsanto is doing something creepy in the Caribbean. For all of our listeners who are from Puerto Rico, you want to stay tuned for that. We have a lot to share. Can't say we're going to get to everything, but let's begin. This is from Yale University and published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And what they're saying is that if you are able to meditate, you can switch off areas of the brain associated with daydreaming, as well as psychiatric disorders like autism and schizophrenia. And so that's important. So meditation's ability to help people stay focused on the moment has been associated with increased happiness levels. Now, according to Professor Justin Brewer, professor of psychiatry and lead author of the study, understanding how meditation works will aid investigation into a host of diseases. Here's what he says, quote, meditation has been shown to help in variety of health problems, such as helping people quit smoking, coping with cancer, and even prevent psoriasis. Now, I will go a little further here. I'm glad to see that this is being done. Let's travel back to the Institute of Applied Biology on the Upper East Side and across the street, Trafalgar Hospital. And I was affiliated with both as a research scientist and research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology, and also with Trafalgar Hospital. They had one of the largest drug and alcohol abuse centers for treatment in the country. Their primary focus for drug addicts was methadone, and they gave different medications for getting people off alcohol. So if they had alcohol, they'd get deadly ill and vomit. I didn't see where that was working, so I suggested to the director, let's try two things, meditation and biofeedback. Because generally someone who is on drugs is very hyper, and it's very hard to get a sense of focus. So as an experimental program, we took a small number of people, 50 people that I was working with, counseling on an evening, every evening, and I said, let's just try a different approach. Let's see what happens when we slow down our thinking and put something positive in place of the urge to take a substance. And it was very simple. We would have a light in the room, and this light would go on and off and on and off in about 3-second cycles. And it was a low-watt bulb, about a 25-watt bulb. Now, historically, some psychologists use that little clicker. It's a little wand that would go from left side to right side, left side to right side. I just thought that this little system would be a little easier to focus on, and indeed it worked. And so I'd put people in a very relaxed state, and then I asked them to think of just one thought that they would give them joy and happiness and allow them to feel at peace, relaxed. And I said, now every time, and we would do this for about 10 minutes, every time you feel this urge to take a drug, an urge to drink alcohol, remember, that will not get you the outcome you deserve or want. But stay focused and it will. After the initial, I would say, 6 months, we had a lot of people who did not go back to drugs. In fact, the director commented at a meeting with the leading psychologist who was working at the time in a Monday morning session. We would have him go over all the different research projects. Says, why don't we start doing more on a non-pharmaceutical basis? And then I got to run this whole division, and we had most people would stop and reflect. It was meditation. What they're talking about now, meditate on something positive, and it helps you get through some otherwise highly reactive times. Now we understand better what is actually happening. I'll explain this. Every single thing that happens in our life is there for our entire life. Nothing is ever forgotten. Just accessing that information is the challenge, because there are physiological limitations as we age, and because of our diet and alcohol and stress, a lot of these dendrites and the neurons become dysfunctional. So quite simply, we can't get to where we need to get to access the information that at one time was so easy to come by. Now we know we can rebuild that physiologically, and we're doing that. But there's something else involved here. Since every thought is there, as an adult, you can sit and look at information, and you can decide whether the information is of value or not. And if you do some homework, whether or not you can trust the information, more or less, or not. But as children, you can't. You virtually emotionalize everything. There is no intellectual process in infants, toddlers, and young children. So you are impressionable that if something is being done, frequently it's because you're responsible for it. And hence, a lot of children grow up with very low self-esteem and feeling very bad about themselves because of comments made by one or both of their caregivers or others around them. Or, on the other hand, feeling better about themselves because of, again, comments said that are more sensitive, more thoughtful, loving, and then the gestures themselves. I once knew a fella who was from England. And he came from a upper middle class background, and he went to a good school. He finally went to Cambridge. And I noticed something in the interrelationship he had with his own children. He was very patient with them and very thoughtful and would talk with them a great deal. Never saw a bond, like, you know, a big hug and a kiss and, you know, the kind of play that you have with your children. And I asked him about this. And he stopped and we just reflected on this moment. He said, well, I never had that as a kid. You know, it was just unheard of for the type of father I had to have given me that kind of bonding. It just didn't happen. And I guess because I didn't know what to do with my own children. I'd feel very uncomfortable. Now, we can always try to figure these things out later in life. And some are able to do that through various forms of therapy. But it's still there. The tape is there. The capacity to react is there. The capacity to shut down no matter what truth you're faced with, no matter what reality you're faced with, and turn back to some old conditioned, foolish tape. So if you can do meditation, which allows you to become mindful the moment you're in, and that's the key, that's what meditation does. It brings you back to the moment. It takes you out of the past. it in effect, it puts stop. You push stop on all those reactive tapes, to be angry, to be sad, to be reactive, to act out. Instead, you're just mindful in the moment. And you're mindful of a word or a vision, something that is beautiful, something that is soothing, something that is pleasurable. And that is what meditation does. And that's what they're saying. So think of how many times in a day we should take little timeouts before we react, before we say something, write something, and do something that then you can't change. When you say something that's unkind and insensitive to another person, you can apologize, and you should. But more often than not, we're not apologizing because we really believe we should be apologizing. We're apologizing out of fear of loss. Well, if I don't apologize, I could lose my job, or I could lose this relationship, or I could lose something. So it does not have the same energy, and hence doesn't have the same capacity for healing. And then watch for patterns. If someone does something really stupid, says something really insensitive, then apologizes, do they do it again? We're all going to do things in life that are just downright stupid. No one is beyond this. The key is, do we learn the lesson and then not do that again? Watch for the pattern. It is the pattern of behavior that determines whether or not someone is mindful, is able to have enough emotional discipline that allows the present mind, which is the spiritual mind, to dictate how to respond. Or are they going back to those old tapes and repeating it over and over and over and ad nauseum? And then you see what you have to deal with and why a lot of relationships will not work, because you're not dealing with a relationship. You're dealing with a person's unfurled past, which is endless in its capacity to have emotional minefields buried. Just one word said, one gesture said, innocent as it may be, and suddenly a person reacts. And you just don't know, well, how many more are there? 200 million? So I got to expect what? A pleasant moment and an attack moment? Yep. So you'll say something good, but then you'll say something really mean? Yep. And you'll apologize and do it all over again? Yep. Well, then that person's not the problem. You accepting that is the problem. There must be a consequence to every action in life, positive or negative. It's only when we understand that we grow. Now, this leads into this idea of a new study from the University of Missouri. An economist, Harvey James, finds a relationship between life satisfaction and low tolerance for unethical conduct. I found this very positive. Let me share this. He says, and this was published in the peer-reviewed journal, Kyklos, the just man is happy and the unjust man is miserable. Who said that? Anyone who understands philosophy in this audience would know immediately. Plato, from the Republic. Well, it is a noble thought, but Socrates' most famous student didn't have the data to back up his belief. On the other hand, the University of Missouri has done some research on this. The research, quote, I found a correlation on how people responded to ethics questions and their satisfaction with life. And then what I found is generally people who believe that these particular ethical scenarios are not acceptable also tend to indicate that they are more satisfied with life. Now, what does this mean in the real-world setting, in lay language? It means if you're a person who sees good in things, if you're a person who tries to find happiness in ways that are constructive and positive, if you try to work with what you have instead of always being angry about what you don't have, generally you'll find people who will find a reason to be negative because of what they don't have, and you'll also find people who are positive for what they do have. Those people who find a positive mindset are going to be more critical than the person who is willing to be negative because they know the truth of what is unjust and they will call it out. They cannot sit by and see an injustice and stay quiet. That's part of what allows them to be happy. going to bed at night knowing you've done something today. You've written a letter, you've emailed, you've gone to a demonstration, you've given support to something that is important, a social, political, cultural, religious, something that makes a difference, because you were trying to right a wrong. The just man syndrome, that allows you to sleep at night because you have not watched injustice, heard it, participated in it, and just went along to get along, to protect yourself, to protect your job or your career or relationship. You just didn't address it. That is the unsatisfied person. That is the adaptive survivalist. And they are miserable. And that's the meaning. Socrates had it right. Plato had it right. And now we're seeing ethical people are more satisfied with life. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
What a lovely trip. I'm feeling so fresh and alive, and I'm so glad to arrive. It's all so grand. It's easy to see. You don't need a palace to feel like Alice in Wonderland. Back in Ohio, where I
welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Now our commentary, an issue I'd like for you to address, please, and to follow up on why we should all be doing everything within our power to stop the Senate Bill 1867. It is beginning today at 1 o'clock. This is the National Defense Authorization Act. It was passed by the House on May 26, a vote of 222-96. And 95 Democrats said yes to this, and 90 Democrats from the Progressive Coalition said yes. Well, it tells you that they have no concept of true progressivism. In any case, we do not want this, because this is just terrible. This will take away rights. And then we did a little research. Now, who's supporting the bill behind the scene? Who are the lobbyists putting money into politicians' their re-election campaigns? Defense electronic contractors, the spy groups, the defense industry, the energy production and services, chemical industry, optical instruments and lenses, the fabricated metals products industry, hardware and tools, small arms and ammunition, textiles and fabrics. Eric Kanner, a Republican, lots of money he got, he said yes. Steve Heuner, Democrat, he got about the same amount of money. He said yes, too. Kay Grainer, Republican. Benny Thompson, Democrat. James Clyburn, Democrat. Joff Davis, Republican. Bill Young, Republican. Michael Rogers, Republican. And you follow the money trail, and all these people got lots of money, and then they voted yes. So as most of us are aware, our entire Congress is corrupt. It is a vile cesspool at every level. And shame on the Democrats and shame on the Republicans for not having the decency and ethics to see what our Congress and our government has become at all levels. The state, the county, everything is corrupt in politics. It doesn't work, except if you can hire the lobbyist and get things your way. So I hope that you call your senator today, email your senator 1,000 times, and let him know or her know, vote no, absolutely vote no on this, because we don't want it. It is against the American public. will have a police state completely. It gives the President of the United States the authorization that he can arrest anyone, hold anyone indefinitely, without trial, without lawyers, without anything. No protections whatsoever. A complete fascist state. That's what they're advocating. That's what they're pushing for. And a whole industry of people that will spy on Americans and implanted identity chips. It's all coming. And much of it is here. So I'm asking you to call and say no to Senate Bill 1867. Now, that leads us into this short commentary from Dr. William Black. And I'm quoting him verbatim. In the savings loan crisis, which was 1/70th the size of this crisis, our agency made over 10,000 criminal referrals that resulted in the conviction on felony grounds of over 1,000 of the elite one percenters in what was designated a major case. And to pick up on what's going on today, this is not just some sidelight to economics. This is why we have recurrent intensifying crises. It is these epidemics of fraud from K Street, from the CEOs and CFOs and major corporations. In the savings loan crisis, the inevitable National Commission said that fraud was invariably present at the typical large failure. In the Enron era, always frauds from the very top of the organization. In this crisis, the frauds came from the very top of the organizations again. But what's different in this crisis? In this crisis, the same agency that I work with that made 10,000 criminal referrals to a tinier crisis made today zero criminal referrals. They got rid of the entire function. And so there are zero convictions of anybody in the elite ranks of Wall Street. And if they can defraud us with impunity, they will cause crisis after crisis and they will produce maximum inequality. The group that has the audacity to refer to itself as the productive class is the largest destroyer of lives, jobs, and wealth of any group ever produced in this world. They wiped out 6 million existing jobs and 5 to 6 million jobs that would have been created. They've left 26 million Americans wanting full-time work with no ability to find that work. If you look at just losses in the household sector, it's $11 trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. And then they have the nerve to say they are the productive class. And not this journalist, but what we have is faux journalism today. Repeats this endless as if it were a fact that they create jobs. No, they destroy jobs. They are mass destroyers of jobs. During the Reagan administration and after the scandal, there was an effort at re-regulation on the savings and loans because that's where I was working. I will tell you this, everyone opposed regulation of the industry. The big deregulation bill, the equivalent of the repeal of the Glass-Steagall and such, occurred in 1982 and became effective in 1983. And by 1983, we were already re-regulating the savings loan industry. We were called re-regulators because that was the greatest swear word the Reagan administration believed existed, to call people re-regulators. But this was not partisan. A majority of the members of the House of Representatives at the time, controlled by the Democrats, co-sponsored a resolution saying, do not go forward with re-regulation. In other words, let the industry do what it wants. Five U.S. senators who became known as the Keating Five, because the most infamous fraud of that era, the Keating scandal, got them together. And who, by the way, did Charles Keating, who created all this fraud, use to recruit the Keating Five? Who was his sidekick? Who did all the facilitating? Who brought him into Washington, D.C.? Who opened doors? Well, a guy named Alan Greenspan. And that's the reality. It was Alan Greenspan who put in writing that Keating's Lincoln savings pose no foreseeable risk of loss. It was also the most expensive failure, a 3,000-position error by Greenspan. And after he got everything wrong in the most important issue he had to deal with, and after the fact, what did we do? Well, we named him head of the Federal Reserve, where he could promote his incompetence to help the 1%. The Reagan administration was so outraged that we were closing insolvent bankrupt savings and loans with great political support that the House of Management and Budget threatened to file criminal referral against the head of our agency on the grounds that we were closing too many insolvent bad banks. Do we have that problem recently? You bet. You see Timothy Geithner, our Secretary of the Treasury. Is he out there trying to close these big powerful banks? No. And the Reagan administration tried to appoint two members. There were only three members running the entire place. And that would give Charles Keating, the most notorious fraudster in that era, in the savings loan crisis. And he, Charles Keating, selected the two individuals to run the agency that would then regulate him. One of them got knocked out on ambiguous political grounds, and the other I had to blow the whistle on to get him to resign in disgrace. Did we prosecute him? No. We can prosecute these frauds. The Federal Housing Finance Administration has just filed complaints against 17 of the largest banks in the United States for committing massive fraud, endemic fraud. And there's a paper trail proving they did so. So where is our Obama Justice Department? Why is it not indicting these clear frauds? When you are told no one could see this crisis coming, ask him about the subprime crisis of 1990 to 91. It's a trick question. As all good things do in the world of fraud, this one started in Orange County, where you had significant people making liar loans. Now remember, it is the lenders who put the lies in the liar loans, not the borrowers. We know this empirically, and we stopped that because it was insane as regulators. And guess what happened? The leading folks making liar loans, making up their federal charter, gave up their federal deposit insurance and became a mortgage bank for the sole purpose of escaping regulation. And they changed their name. Some of you will recognize this name, Ameriquest. Ameriquest was the leading predatory lender in the United States in making liar loans, and they specifically targeted minorities, blacks and Latinos. And then they were caught. They were caught three times doing this, and the Justice Department refused to prosecute them. Instead, they settled for $400 million, and guess what happened to the head liar, the head honcho who created the entire fraud of Ameriquest? Let's see. A, he resigned in disgrace. B, he was indicted, found guilty, and sent to jail. And C, we made him ambassador to the Netherlands. Got it right. We made him ambassador to the Netherlands. Go figure. Why do you think we made him ambassador to the Netherlands? Because he was the leading political contributor to the President of the United States. And that's bad, but what comes next is worse. Remember, this is the most notorious fraud in the nation up to that point. It targets minorities. Everybody knows it does so. Two entities rushed in to acquire these personnel and this business in their names, Citicorp and Washington Mutual, who became two of the most notorious frauds in all of this. When we prosecuted, we had a 90% conviction rate when they had the best criminal defense lawyers in the world, and they spent money like water to protect the CEOs from going to prison. So when they tell you no one can stop this, it's utter nonsense. I'll leave you with these statistics. The FBI warned in September 2004, in an open testimony, it warned expressly that there was an epidemic, and I'm quoting, quote, an epidemic of fraud, mortgage fraud, and it predicted it would cause financial crisis. If that's not enough, the industry's own anti-fraud experts in 2006, in writing, went to every mortgage banker in America, virtually every other lender, and said three things. Stated income loans are an open invitation to fraud. The incidence of fraud in such loans is 90%, and these loans deserve the phrase used by the industry behind closed doors. These are liar loans because they are pervasively fraudulent. How did they get? Well, What did the industry do after it was warned? Did it stop making these loans? No. It massively increased the amount of these loans. And here is a statistic people in this audience should listen to. One out of every three home loans in America was a liar's loan. And that's why we have this crisis. And it came from the very top of the organizations and went through all the different agencies. Now, that's that. Now, let me just add a comment here. Let us not be so ingenious that we assume that the 1% are solely responsible for the crisis we're in today. Because for them to do a liar's loan, the person receiving the loan had to acknowledge and sign that, I'm making $120,000 a year, when in fact they were making $20,000. Let us allow the responsible people who lied out of greed. And that was an awful lot of Americans. Millions and millions of Americans lied. And why not, they felt. Why should I be denied my opportunity to buy something at $100,000 and then in a year it's worth $200,000 and 5 years worth $500,000? So pervasive lying. So it was endemic across the entire spectrum. We have not had the courage to take an honest look at the 99% and say, and what exactly have you done? What choices have you made that have empowered, emboldened, and caused the control of the 1%? If we did that, then we wouldn't be using supercilious 99-1 figures. It would be closer to 50-50. An awful lot of Americans do a lot of stupid things, selfish things, greedy things, insensitive things, self-serving things, every choice they make. So before they scream being a victim, they should take a really careful introspection and then let them reevaluate. That's the only way we're going to break some of these habits. And also, I'm hearing more and more people talk about people's freedom of speech. You know, they've had their say, they should go now. I have some really concerns that what could have been and still may be an opportunity to cause America to shift its focus together to make a real change may not end up having any of that occur. But that does not mean people should in any way be limited in their freedom of speech. Do you actually know the full First Amendment when it comes to it? It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peacefully to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. I believe that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, all those who were part of writing our amendments, did so with the idea that they should have the power to challenge those who had undue power and undue influence. If a person is ranting something that all of us would agree is irresponsible, they still have a right to rant. I can disagree with it. I can walk away from it. I do not believe that person should be stopped from that rant. But I also believe that we have gone through tremendous self-censorship. I would like to see the members of the union writing and speaking up without fear of retribution against the corrupt management and leadership of most unions. I would like to see the school teachers by the tens of thousands who know the curriculum they're teaching is wrong, who know that how it's being taught is wrong, who know the influence the special publishers and the special writers and the special administration set up that is all corrupt. And yet they know also that they've seen from those courageous teachers who have stood up, they've been thrown into rubber rooms or reprimanded by their own unions. Where is freedom of speech in those unions? Where is freedom of speech in the soldier who sees what is wrong? Pat Tillman was killed by friendly fire, and then it was covered up clear to the Secretary of Defense. And yet in the military, you're not allowed to tell the truth. You're not allowed to speak out. Where does it say anywhere in our Constitution, in any law, that once you don a uniform in the United States, you no longer have your First Amendment right of free speech There are no exceptions. And where is our military speaking out? Why have we not had more people coming forward and telling the truth about the atrocities, the truth about the fraud and the corruption in all of our military efforts? And where have we not had those employees working in federal agencies come forward and tell that the work that is done is unnecessary, the corporate contracts are massive, and they do nothing to help make America a better, safer place? Where's your freedom of speech? Are you afraid because you'll be dealt with? For the teachers, do not forget Pickering versus the Board of Education. The Supreme Court in 1968 ruled in a seminal public employee First Amendment case that school officials had violated the first rights of teachers such as Marvin Pickering when they fired him for writing a letter to his local paper criticizing allocation of money between academics and athletes. Where are the doctors who are not writing about the vast amount of non-scientific medicine that's being practiced? We have a freedom of speech, and yet we seem limited in stating it. Your thoughts, please. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And by the way, 90 House Democrats voted against the bill. And tomorrow is the amendment, which is in the Senate. It's supposed to strip out the offensive language about habeas corpus. We don't want this. We want to stop this. All right? We want to stop this bill. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment, we'd like to hear your thoughts on the fact that we have massive corruption, massive and endemic, at every level of our government, financial industries. And we're not talking about 1%. Stop this stupidity before you become indoctrinated in it. There's 7 million people work in the financial sector alone. How can you blame the CEO of Goldman Sachs and not everyone else who makes bonuses and profits from the money they make, including making money on nothing more than derivatives? When everybody gets the bonus, then everybody is responsible. My God, we have to think deeper and more profound than what we are now. I'm embarrassed at the left. I'm embarrassed at the Democrats for sucking up to a movement just because it is gaining them some political leverage. We need to look for the truth, and we're not doing it, and we're going through self-censorship, including on many of the radio stations. Where did you have the truth to talk about 9/11? Instead, you hid because you did not want to exercise that freedom of speech. Where were your commentaries on the JFK assassination, Martin Luther King assassination? Where were your commentaries on the AIDS fraud and on vaccines? Where did you use your freedom of speech? Think well on this. I look forward to your answer. Back in a moment.
Ladies never embrace.
A barber for a ball would be a social disgrace.
They all will come to call if you can fall on your face.
Be a clown, be a clown, be a clown.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. We're going into the studio now, but let's first say hello to Ed from Los Angeles. Hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Listen, I just wanted to talk to you about the police state, which I think we already have. We have a culture of society that doesn't want to question authority. And we don't question authority because in the education system we're taught to be good citizens. And I know from two jobs I had where there were two unions and the restaurants were going to try to roll back the wages, steal money. I was the only one in both cases who went to the union and got the both restaurants to give us overtime and to give us back our tip money that they were stealing. And the point I'm trying to make is most people will not question authority, unfortunately. It takes a very few. When Martin Luther King marched on Washington, it was only 3% of the black movement that marched with him and everybody else.
Under 1%.
Under 1%, I'm sorry, under 1%. So the point I'm trying to make is, I was told at this restaurant that I worked at that served President Reagan and President Bush that because I had told the union what they were doing, I had created ripples in that restaurant that hadn't been seen there in 40 years. And I'd only worked there 3 years in the 80s, and I'm thinking, my God, that means people were suffering there for 40 years and did nothing. And it took me to go tell the union and get the people overtime and get the people back their tips and their wages.
When you see an injustice, speak it. When you refuse to speak it, then look at your First Amendment rights. You are withholding a major weapon you have, a peaceful, nonviolent weapon, and to direct grievances. We got to run. Thank you. And we have, let's see, one more here. I'll take Chris from Queens. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Good afternoon, Gary. I wanted to tie in to what you were saying. Just witness the way Americans have succumbed to the humiliating experience of flying and being literally felt up when you go to the airport without any objection. I mean, we heard a little bit of whining here and there, but it was dropped. You know, not to mention the fact that this could be so injurious to our health in the long term, but the fact that they submitted to that degree, it's been such a thing for me. It was more disappointing for me not that they implemented this, but the lack of resistance, that people should literally have either sat down at the airport or done something. You know, this whole idea, and it's indicative in everything in the last, I would say, a good 15, 20 years. I won't even go back to the 80s because people still spoke up at some point. It's just scary that technology has contributed so much to this. In other words, not to knock down the good parts of it, but, you know, we're so used to now, we press a button and the computer thinks for us. We no longer have to bother to even, you know, walk to the dictionary and look up the etymology of a word because we get the definition on screen. And this exercise is really, you know, it's a diminishing of our ability to develop intellectually and to develop our imagination. It's really scary. So this new bill should be something that should be on the lips of every so-called left person on the radio and on television. And what do we hear? We hear about the sexual escapades of Mr. Kane. You know, it's just obscene. That's what I want to say.
What we should do, I don't think that that we learned our lesson about the contradiction between what if you grope someone sexually on the street outside of an airport, you would be arrested for sexual violation. Inside, they can grope you, and it's not a violation. If you resist that, they can taser you, they can arrest you, they can handcuff you. In the case of one woman, they tasered her and she died. Therein is where we do not recognize, we adapt. We do not recognize a violation. We simply are so tolerant and so indifferent, unless we are of a defiant nature, in which case then we will be indignant and we will state that indignancy. By the way, this act that we're referring to, this allows the president to determine who he feels is a threat to the United States. Now, in the current definition, the FBI already has decided that anyone demonstrating against policies of the United States are to be labeled as terrorist, and hence they are being watched, they are being photographed, they're put on list. So you can take the idea that this would never happen in America, it is happening in America. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. In studio, we have Jason, and we're going to go to our guests in 2 minutes. So, Jason and Elizabeth. Hi, Jason. We'll start with you.
Hi, Gary. How are you today?
Good.
Well, Gary, I just really wanted to congratulate you. Yesterday on the Progressive Commentary Hour, you had one of the best scientists and two of the best journalists on discussing original concepts that showed an embarrassing lack of trust on Pacifica's half on the war on AIDS. The numbers were off the charts, Gary, last night. You set a new record for us on unique visits on our site, plus an additional 31,000 people tuned in and more have downloaded it the whole hour on PRN.FM. And this is just from last night, by the way. The Progressive Commentary Hour, as of last night, had over 8 million searches on Google, Gary. And then you're the only one on this list. This is very impressive. These are just mind-blowing numbers. And Progressive Radio on Google is closing in on 300 million searches as well, with PRN and your show being number one, which is, again, like I said, mind-blowing. In My many years in radio, I've been about 11 to 12 years. I've worked at Sirius. I've worked at NEW. I haven't seen such a phenomenon going on like this. This is a worldwide movement, Gary. This has never been done before. We have had no news stories done on us, no promotions. This is all just word of mouth that you've started.
We don't need official anything.
That's right.
Well, in fact, I don't want official anything. I'm not doing any interviews. I haven't done an interview with the New York Times or anyone or Time Magazine. Last two I did interviews with in years because I don't want us, meaning those in a progressive movement, those who pulled themselves away from the religion, the cult mindset of science, of journalists, of medicine, of healing, of education, of social consciousness, which is also a religious movement. That's why it's failed so miserably in so many cases. I want us to realize we do not need their approval, their support, or their acknowledgement for us to identify what is right and go forward. Because there's nothing we can ever do, ever, any of us, in this world, in any field where we have stepped outside the boundary of official doctrine and showed what could be done better and show it and prove it, that will ever be acceptable to them. So once you have been labeled as a person who is alternative, counter to the existing or prevailing power structure, then you better understand you cannot go back into it. You got to go forward. We don't need them. The world is not going to be controlled by them. I'm not controlled. You're not controlled. And it's showing that we're approaching, 290 million hits, searches?
Yes, sir.
Well, we're almost at 300 million. Who would have figured, who would have guessed, that many people would free themselves from the limitations of their own belief systems to look for the truth elsewhere. So good for everyone doing that. By the way, this latest little news brief, I was watching, this is the Boris report about Kane's sexual escapade. When a new poll of likely GOP voters, 20% think Herman Cain had an extramarital affair, 20% do not think he had an extramarital affair, and 44% are having an affair with Herman Cain right now. So, thank you, Jason.
Thank you, Gary.
Hi. Elizabeth, over to you.
Yes, a quick one here for you. This is from Linda. She's emailed in to say that she listens regularly to your show. She's now reading the book Flourish by Martin Seligman, the founder of Positive Psychology. She says lots of people are into this book, but asks, do you support it? As recently she'd heard that you'd said that you'd had a lot of issues with it. Could you be specific, please?
Well, this is just another part of this feel-good psychology movement. I consider it an illusion. I consider it counterintuitive because what it does, it does not provide for the deeper understanding of our conditioned self. It believes that we can overcome any emotional weakness just by thinking happy, positive thoughts. I have never found that to be right. I thought, and I said at the time, that The Secret, which was the previous big hot one, was equally foolish. But when people want to look for the truth, where everyone wants to seek happiness. So what is the quickest way? What is the fast food approach to happiness? Oh, well, then let's go out and buy this particular book. Fine, if they feel that that's going to do something for them. But I find that it does not. Siegelman's whole idea is to produce temporary happiness. But that's all an illusion. It becomes a happiness cult. It becomes a happiness religion. It does nothing to deepen the awareness that we are all spiritual beings. And all you have is a bunch of smiley, happy, grinning people looking you in the eye. But when you ask them, and at what point does all this end? It ends when their authentic needs are not met and the deep awareness is not reached and the negative conditioning then shows itself, because in every relationship, work, family, it is not the best that you are that determines how far you go. It is the worst that you are that intercedes and adversely affects someone. You don't stop a relationship because it's too loving, too hugging, too kissing, too wonderful, too passionate. You don't fire someone because they're too good. It is the negative that surfaces, and that undermines this happy, feel-good, positive psychological makeup. These people are just detached from the reality. The reality is that we are all suffering from unconscious conflict. And as a result, we are repetitively recycling this. And then that creates negative emotions, negative outcomes, and then we don't know what to do with it, so we go back and smile again and read the next positive affirmation. That kind of dualism, bouncing between a happy thought and a negative action, does not change the psychic's inner dynamics. And all we have is inner rebellion. And that causes more self-defeating, self-sabotaging behavior. There's basically two layers involved in every reaction. There is that which we are completely unaware of. We don't remember it, we don't think about it, but it is a negative conditioned minefield. And that's what produces our negative reactions. Then we have what we are conscious of. We are conscious that we were not loved, or we were not handled right, or we were not spoken to right, or we refused something, or we were overly controlled, and we were being subjected to something that we felt bad about, and we didn't like the person doing it. That's our conscious negativity. So we have a combination of unconscious and conscious negativity that is every day, 95% of our actions, that's what comes in our mind before we decide how we're going to respond. And so until such time that we're willing to get to the deeper, more meaningful ways of resolving these issues, then all these happy thought philosophies is nothing more than just pop culture at its worst. Right. And today we are nothing more than an egocentric culture.
Right. Thank you. Very profound.
And so I'm opposed to this whole Siegelman's drama of the positive psychology, and flourish. So he's got the next best popular selling book. We'll see a whole lot of him for a while, but then ask how many people in a year from now are better. Because if you can't deal with what's an illusion in your life, then all you're going to do is corrupt your life. And what I said earlier, how many of the 99 percenters see themselves as being greedy, participating? How many are eating the fast foods, giving their children diabetes and heart disease? How many of them are buying things like on Black Friday they didn't need with money they didn't have, and then being angry at the 1% who gave them the opportunity to do that, who owned the Walmarts, who had the credit cards they maxed out, all so they could stampede a person, see a person die, but not be wasting time calling an ambulance or helping that person because they had to buy that waffle maker for $2, like they needed the waffle maker or they needed the wafer to go with the other 65 extra pounds of fat around their head, and it's not so well the body. No, please do not try to give me an excuse why I should feel sympathy or empathy for a lot of people who are in the process of living in complete and total denial, not the least of which is the left and the right, the religions, the educational system, our government, almost everyone in between. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you very much.
Over to my guest now, Evelyn Pringle, award-winning investigative journalist focused on exposing corruption in government and corporate America. And very important work she has done. Nice to have you with us today, Evelyn.
Hi, Gary.
Evelyn, we're going to focus on one issue only today because we're going to be having you back for a full hour on our Progressive Commentary Hour when we're going to be doing a special on the drugging of our children.
Yes.
I want you to talk about the idea of creating diseases, mental diseases, that do not exist solely for the purpose of selling drugs to these children, and how the medical community, the scientific community, the media, the legislature have all participated in this effort, and why none of these people are standing on the side of truth or the child. Your turn.
Wow, that's a big agenda.
Speak
Gary.
Up. You're a little
how much
low
time are you giving me? I really think the inventing of diseases for children started with ADHD or ADD, attention deficit disorder, to begin with, and then branched out to adding the hyperactivity. And I think when the pharmaceutical industry saw the profits that could be made off of that in children, that's when it really took off. And, of course, prior to it taking off was the prelude to the new generation of psychiatric drugs, which the antidepressants that came out starting in late 1987 with Prozac. Well, people need to understand that those drug companies knew those drugs were coming out long before they ever came out. So when we back up to the ADHD days, we know that the drug companies already knew they were having those drugs to come out. So when they saw what happened with the stimulants, with Ritalin, and later Adderall and Dexedrine and those stimulants, how much money could be made by convincing parents that their kids had a mental disorder, then they thought, well, let's move on to depression. Let's say that teens have depression because they knew that the antidepressants were coming out. And I think that there were several things that happened that added to this plan to expand the market to children. And one was that the Disability Act, where they started allowing kids that originally Disability Act, Individuals with Disability Act, was for kids like with Down syndrome or cerebral palsy or things like this, where kids were really disabled. But when they got it so that the government, the legislators, agreed to pass it so that ADHD was also a disability, well, that really added. That really helped the pharmaceutical industry because that meant that the schools could start getting money for each kid that was disabled by a mental disorder, and the parents could start getting money each month for the children that had a mental disorder. So they got money for that, the parents, and also got all their medical bills covered. So that expanded it because then they got to, the drug companies knew that they had guaranteed payment for these drugs. So that moved up to when the antidepressants came out, and it started where the teens, like I said, let's say that teens get depressed now. And actually, if you follow this along, which I've done, chronicled this along, the timeline that I've made, that actually the Ritalin and the stimulants cause depression. I mean, any speed freak will tell you that. When they're coming off of speed stimulants, they get depressed, and they learn to live with that. That's not a mental disorder. That's a side effect of the drugs. So that fed right into being diagnosing teens depressed and saying, well, they need to be on antidepressants. And so then, you know, they made, if you had a child that was diagnosed severely depressed, those too could probably get parents money for that child and get the drugs and all their medical care paid for. So this all came together like this, and the lawmakers, you know, fed into this by passing these laws and saying, yes, now we'll deem people, kids, mentally disordered if they have depression. And so then we move on to the antidepressants once they start giving those to children, even though they weren't approved for children or teens, then the antidepressants caused mania. So we move along into the 1990s, and we've got the Ritalin causing depression. Then we give them the antidepressants. The kids, the antidepressants, they cause mania. So then we've got kids that are looking like they're getting real manic-y at some point in the day and then getting real depressed at some point in the day. But in truth, if they were on those two drugs, then both of those are side effects of the drugs. So then we move into the 90s, and the drug companies see how well that this is working with the antidepressants and the stimulants, selling those to kids, that they decide, well, let's say that these kids now have bipolar, which is unheard of in children at this point. So, okay, when they decide that, then they go about and they hire academics at major universities. Of course, with children, the bipolar, the main one was Joseph Biederman at Harvard. Well, we go into the early 90s, and we have him putting out studies from studies saying that, yes, these children are bipolar. A large percentage of the kids we see with ADHD are actually bipolar. So they put these studies in major medical journals and pass them around, and then, of course, the drug companies will buy copies of these studies and send them to doctors all over the country. And so then, voila, we have invented bipolar disorder in children. When, in actuality, again, in review, the stimulants will cause depression when you're coming at them, and they could also cause the kids to get manic. And then we've got the SSRI antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft and Paxil coming along, giving them, those cause kids to get manic-y. So here we have invented bipolar, which in essence, if you really want to get technical about it, bipolar in children was a side effect of two drugs, the SSRIs and the antidepressants. I mean, the stimulants. So then we'll move it along, and they come along and they decide, well, that works so well that we're going to expand it, and we're going to say that these epilepsy drugs work in treating bipolar. And so we'll add that to the mix, and those are really anti-seizure drugs. And so they start putting out studies again. They'll pick academics and major universities to do these studies and get them published in medical journals, And then we'll say, well, to treat the bipolar, we've got to give them epilepsy drugs. And about the same time, they were called mood stabilizers. They referred to them as mood stabilizers. That term came, I think that term came into existence, mood stabilizer, in the early 90s. Okay, when Abbott came out with Depakote. Okay, so then we've got these bipolar children that are really side effects from the other drugs, and they say these epilepsy drugs will help them with this bipolar. Then, right about the same time, we come out with Johnson & Johnson's coming out with Risperdal. I believe that was in 93 or 94. Well, the Risperdal can be used to treat children with bipolar that become manic-y. And so they start giving them these drug cocktails. And you have to understand that all this time, none of these drugs are approved for children, okay? Without the academics at the universities putting out these studies and saying that the disease exists to begin with, the bipolar, they wouldn't have had any market to sell these, because if a disorder isn't in the DSM, like pediatric bipolar, they wouldn't have any, the FDA would never approve a drug to treat that. Okay, so at this time, the SSRI antidepressants weren't approved for children, for depression even, and when the antipsychotics came out, they were not approved, and they were not approved for bipolar, period, at that point. They were approved for schizophrenia and psychosis. So here we've got kids in about the mid-90s that were starting to prescribe them, then when they have bipolar, with the antipsychotics, and Zyprexa came out, the next one in 1996, I believe, and then with the epilepsy drugs. So this is creating a market out of thin air, because there are no drugs approved for these kids to be giving them that, let alone is there a disorder called pediatric bipolar. There's no such thing. There still isn't in the DSM.
Evelyn, what we have here is you've given us a very nice timeline, just showing our audience how we went from having normal children doing the things that children do and always have and expressing themselves as they always have, which are completely natural, and manufacturing illnesses, labeling them, co-opting and scientists at universities to give them authenticity or credibility, and then marketing. We look forward to our 1 to 2 hour special on the Progressive Commentary Hour on the drugging of our children. This was just a sneak preview of what they can expect. My guest, Evelyn Pringle, P-R-I-N-G-L-E, and she is at evelynpringle.blogspot.com. Thank you very much, Evelyn. We look forward to an in-depth discussion on this coming up. I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you all very much for listening. Stay tuned to the Whistleblowers Hour coming at you right now.
Just singing in the rain, what a glorious feel, and I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart, and I'm ready for love. Let the storm.
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.
I'll walk down the lane with a hand.